This is Mary Flynn at Blackbird. We're in our office in Richmond, Virginia with Peter Sheldahl, the art critic of The New Yorker, and Susan Glasser and Howard Rosati from Richmond. And Mr. Sheldahl has been kind enough to let us talk to him for a while about art and what's going on in it, a little Polaroid snapshot. Sort of talking around, trying to think about what some people might be interested in. Richard Carline, who's a Richmond artist, wondered if you thought there were any hope for art right now, whether it's been subsumed by popular culture or whether there's a difference or whether it's even something that people care about anymore.
Franz Kafka once said, there is infinite hope, but not for us. I guess that would depend on whether you include yourself in that us or not. There's infinite hope. People get up in the morning and make art, look at art, think about art, sell it. No, the art world isn't broken.
Could you say, as a way of really addressing this question again, could you say something about what it's like to have a life or make a life in art as a critic?
It's a great luxury and a stroke of luck.
Do you find not being connected to an academic situation an advantage?
Oh boy, I'm one of those 60s college dropouts you hear about, so having as my highest academic achievement, a high school diploma, that's shielded from teaching.
Russell Jacoby wrote a book called The Last Intellectuals, and he talked about a time when critics and intellectuals weren't connected to the university, and he thought that was a great thing, and Greenberg and I think Rosenberg would be a part of that group, and he felt that it was an advantage because they didn't get caught up into an academic institutionalized situation. Could you say something about that in terms of your own writing?
Well, I think academics who write about things write for people who have to read them and who, if they show any style or elan in their writing, the readers will just resent it. If people don't want to read me, I starve. There are no rewards in being obscure or abstruse or overbearing for me. You know, I don't think it's because I haven't naturally good character, but writing things that people want to read, you know, is my bread and butter.
You said that critics can be wrong, but they have to be right sometimes.
Often wrong, but never in doubt. Having an opinion is sort of part of your social contract with readers. I mean, they want to know what you think. And if you don't know what you think, you just take a stab at it. In a way, the advancement of opinions is the least interesting thing about criticism for me, but it's one of the essentials to launch you into a situation, into a conversation.
Are there things that you look back on that you think you've gotten quite right or that you've gotten terribly wrong in retrospect?
Well, I've changed my mind. Franz Kline, the abstract expressionist, was sort of a jazzy guy, and he said a kind of Zen koan that I often think of. It said, to be right is the most terrific personal state that nobody is interested in. That about sums it up. Right or wrong in terms of what? I mean, it's like right or wrong in terms of judging your distance if you're jumping motorcycles over cars or something. I mean, that's important. You know, going to war, right and wrong, very important. Right or wrong about art, I mean, geez, who cares? It's an activity whose beginning and end point is pleasure. And there are people who are right in boring ways and wrong in exciting ways.
Who's somebody who you've looked at over years in your opinion and the way you sort of find what is alive in their work for you has changed particularly?
Well, the main example would be Philip Guston, probably, you know, who in the 60s, when I was new in New York, had the most refined sort of existential abstract expressionist style, you know, the quiveringly intelligent. And I revered him, and then at the end of the 60s, he switched to this raucous, cartoony style of Ku Klux Klan and sort of self-loathing self-portraits, and I hated it. I just hated it. It was like the priest of my religion defrocking himself. You know. At the same time, I knew a lot of people, particularly younger people, were very moved by it, but I resisted it. And then I don't know, one point maybe in my sleep, I changed my mind and realized, live with it, Peter. I mean, the job of an artist is not to make you comfortable with your ideals. Been on it since. Become an enthusiast for the late Guston. I mean, there's an element of autobiography in all of our stories about art, and I don't regard myself as in some way special among people who look at art. I'm special in that I remember my experience and can analyze and express it. That's my professional specialty, okay? And if everybody could do that, I wouldn't get paid nearly as much as I do. But in general, I think I'm just another art lover with more time and leisure. There are critics who seem not to particularly love art or to have personal uses for it, and I do not understand these people. They scare me.
Well, that seems to be a sort of more recent phenomenon, isn't it? Critics who don't like art.
It's generally a product of academic situations.
I think it is, too. Do you still like the early Guston?
Oh, Christ, yes. It's wonderful stuff. But, you know, I've come to understand it with more complexity as partly a kind of hope against hope of Guston that he was better than he feared he was, you know, as a person, I think. Even he was repressing the kind of abject suicide junk man son that he was. His father was reduced to being a junk man when he was a kid and committed suicide when I think Guston was about 11, and Guston found his body hanging. The kind of raucousness of the late work is partly just relief that this exalted ego, the ideal, artistic ideal that he had maintained, was he just threw it over while retaining that amazing touch, you know, I mean, that amazing color, that great painting ability, which, I mean, early on, I mean, I hated it because it was being subordinated to sort of filling in arbitrary cartoon forms, whereas I thought it should be the prima donna of the canvas. I don't know. I don't get involved in psychodynamics with every artist. I think I do, actually, to a mild extent. That was a case where the sensibility I'd been forming in my 20s was challenged and eventually broken and reformed.
Well, it seems like Guston, one has to like the late work or the early work, though the late work has been much more fashionable. But I think the early work is just terrific.
I don't think they're in competition. The human spirit takes many forms, and anything has a value if you know what it is and if you bother to discern. Otherwise, you're sitting as some kind of judge blocking from the world, from the conversation of culture, things whose values aren't immediately congenial to you. Then you're just a jerk. I mean, I've got certain rules of thumb for work that isn't immediately congenial. One is, what would I like about this if I liked it? That is, I sort of project in my mind somebody who thinks, wow, this is great, this is what I like, you know, and sometimes that idea in my head persuades me, you know, and I come around. Sometimes I come around a little bit, sometimes I agree to disagree, but it enables me to write, I think, intelligently, and if that fails, then I sort of back up and say, what would somebody who likes this be like? You know, then it becomes sort of sociological. Then I'm writing about a taste. You know, sometimes I might think it's a reprehensible taste in some way and write negatively. Other times it's just, look what camel has walked into the tent. You know.
Have you ever started working on a review and by the end of it you've ended up in a place very different than where you thought you were going to, or in the opposite direction of where you began?
I think every time. I mean, and not opposite, but no, I don't know what I think until I write it. No. I'm as often surprised by my reviews as anybody else.
I mean, I think that's one of the wonderful things about real criticism, that it takes you on a journey and you end up someplace that you didn't expect.
Yeah, well, that's the pleasure of it, yeah.
I do find a lot of academic criticism begins with an opinion and then...
The definition of the academic in all things, in art or anything, is that you start from the answer and work back and frame the question. Academic... anything devotes all of its energy to secondary matters. I mean, the primary matters are already assumed, established, and then it becomes a quibble about secondary things. I mean, it's like, you know, an academic painting is, the foot is drawn great, you know, but you're not interested in the person with the foot. So, I mean, I think I'm a pragmatist. I mean, I judge things by their consequences. If the answer to a question doesn't make a whole lot of difference to life one way or another, you don't have a question. It's not a real question. So it's really the impact and significance and ramification of something that...
So you think criticism is a serious endeavor?
Anything serious that you take seriously. I don't know, I mean, for some people don't need it, you know, bully for them. They've got more time for other things.
But you think it does something, it's worthwhile doing, that it has an impact?
I just do it. I mean, that's not for me to judge. You know, I take over where the artist leaves off, the reader takes over where I leave off, which is, yeah, I hope so. You know, I hope it has an impact, but that's out of my hands.
Something you said earlier, you mentioned that there is a responsibility in being a critic, and that it is that you take very seriously writing in a way that people are engaged by.
Well, that's, as I say, a survival question for me. No, I think you're responsible to readers. I mean, I think, but this is any writer who writes for people to read him rather than for, you know, tenure track points or whatever, he's a propagandist to a tyrant or something, I have 100% responsibility to readers. That is, that they know they're getting the straight stuff from me, that I don't have an agenda. Or if I do, that it's spelled out at the top of the piece. I mean, so that they have, there's nothing, you know, behind the scenes of what I'm writing. To the extent that I'm conscious. I mean, God knows we're all have weird, unconscious motivations, but I guess that's where I'd locate responsibility. I don't know that I would take it any farther than that.
People sort of say you're not a theoretical critic in the sense that you think of Greenberg or people who were a part of the abstract expressionist connection. I wonder if that's almost a part of the diversity of the current art world, that there's so many different kinds of things going on,
mm-hmm.
that somebody like you who appreciates a great variety of different kinds of work.
Well, I'm an aesthete, mm-hmm. you know, which is a kind of an antique word. But I think my approach to life is to sort of put a mental frame around whatever I encounter and kind of regard it as if it were art. And it gives me a rather active sense of the ridiculous. Neither here nor there in terms of character or citizenship. I think New York and maybe Los Angeles, the only places in the country where living day to day that way without being clinically depressed is possible. I have respect for ideas. I have respect for even fanatical ideas. Because I see how immensely creative they can be, generally for brief periods. I mean, to sort of explosive corrections of the culture. I'm not anti-theoretical. I'm anti-theoretical establishment. You know, I'm anti-dogmatic anything. I mean, that which seems to be a complete misunderstanding of what art is for. So I get cranky about that.
And do you see any trends sort of moving through things that you're looking at now? I was thinking what you were writing about John Curran.
I think the sort of theoretical PC juggernaut of the 90s is pretty well broken down. And I think it's got a certain kind of residual momentum generally in universities, but in the art scene, it's pretty hard to find anymore. The ball is back in the studio, where people who proceed by, you know, thinking are blessedly confused, and nobody knows what art is, and, you know, it's up to the artists. The 90s were very much, the intellectual and sort of taste trends were very led by curators, in a kind of educational stance toward the unwashed public who, as far as I can tell, never showed up. I think, it's really like there's a whole generation of art activities and shows that were directed to what I think of as the ISV, the incredibly stupid viewer. You know, a great solicitude for this person that he or she be enlightened. Of course, nobody ever admitted to being that person. But I think I like to think that people are remembering why they liked art in the first place, which is generally some kind of epiphany that hit them on the head when they were teenagers, or some sense of a extraordinary order of pleasure and stimulus. And that, you know, that art is responsible for art now. I mean, it won't last. Institutions and dogmas form. There's a lovely period when, for like 6 months, nobody knows what art is, which turned out to be immensely creative in retrospect.
Shifting the topic a little bit, you've mentioned that you think that the true identity of a museum is in its collections, not in its building.
Yes.
And I would take that a step further and say that it's also in how they present those collections. There have been a couple of instances where you've been fairly scathing in your observations about museum installations.
Yes.
What do you think that museums should be doing to facilitate a kind of a theme that runs through an awful lot of your writing about reconstituting the pleasure principle?
I think you put the stuff up and you make sure the light is nice and that the noise level isn't too high. Anything else you do is on you. The point is that a Rembrandt is a Rembrandt, whether it's in the Great Hall of, you know, the National Gallery or in a subway toilet. And I'll go to either place. I'll look at it with a flashlight. I don't care. And I hope I'm not being entirely snarky here in saying that art lovers are a disorganized minority constituency in the conduct of the art culture. You know, we're like selfish children. All we're interested in is art, and we learn to we have our improvised guerrilla tactics, getting in, getting past all of the Gorgons and educators and labels and, you know, getting what we want and then going home, you know, keeping a low profile. I guess maybe I try to serve this constituency, which you can't treat as a constituency. It's like herding cats, right, by amplifying their experience.
Do you think that education is that so many museums in the museum field has redefined its mission according to the American Association of Museums as an educational institution?
Yeah, well, it's a deadly aspect of American culture. Educated for what? You know, where do we get our diplomas? It's a graveyard? I mean, when do we apply our education? But it's interesting. I mean, I think the most sensitive, intelligent, cultivated, exciting people I know in their investments to art do not register on the public level. I mean, they're not part of institutional structures. You wouldn't be caught dead in it. Or sometimes they are. Sometimes they're moles in institutional structures. But they tend to feel pretty bad about themselves. No, you put this stuff up, you turn on the lights, you let the people in. And if they don't want to come in or they're not interested, great. People have to go to football games too. You know, it's not a problem.
Well, I want to disagree with you a little bit, at least, because I do think that in writing for certain kinds of non-academic magazines, mm-hmm. part of what you do is to try and reach an audience and make them understand some things about art or see something or look more attentively.
Yeah.
I mean, I always think a really good criticism is not, as some people suggested, replacing the art, but actually pointing at things. Say, look at this and look at that.
I think it's modeling the conversation. I mean, I think the basis of criticism is like, some people in a museum or gallery talking in front of the art. And I think what I do is maybe a refinement and formalization of that. And if it works, it feeds right back into it. And so it's just raising the level, which is like writing about anything. Sports writing, it's about fans in the stands, and then they see the game, and they come back, and the next day they read it in the paper, and they see the game again, you know, with more understanding, and they have a better conversation on the phone that afternoon, okay?
Well, when they go back to the next game, they see it differently as well.
Yeah, that's a natural appetite. You know, if you like something, you want to know more about it, you want to be more deeply involved in it, you know, you're serving a human impetus. I guess what really is a problem in America, and what I really want to oppose is the idea that art is good for you. It is not medicine. It may not be good for you. There have been people who have been driven mad by art. Art love does not accord with good politics, good morals. You know, Hitler had rather good taste, okay? You know, certainly in architecture and design. I think the Nazi flag was one of the greatest design coups in history. Hitler did it, okay? And that was part of the tinniness of the 90s, of like trying to associate good art with right-thinking politics. No. And I think Baudelaire was very clear about that. I mean, you know, Flowers of Evil. He wrote about dark stuff, and he had an appreciation of dark stuff. He also had an appreciation of virtue. I think if you read Baudelaire carefully, you realize the wildness of the aesthetic, you know, and how somebody who's only aesthetic is a monster. Well, the late 19th century French writer, I mean, Huysmans, Au Rebours, is about that. You know, what the consequences of somebody being only aesthetic. Being an aesthete certainly doesn't fulfill your citizenry. I mean, you know, I'm a voter and a and a good neighborhood person. But in America, we want to square things. We want to get our aesthetic values lined up with our political values, with our moral values. It's a madness. It's a madness which we have survived for a couple hundred years and we'll probably still survive. But it's really annoying. and I want to make it a little more difficult than it normally is.
I was thinking that museums would place a similar